the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's acceptable and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, and this morning we speak with NASA research astrophysicist Dr. Grant Mitchell, who will reveal how NASA's Parker Solar Probe is set to make history on Christmas Eve, December 24th. Then Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy Chad Orzel explores the history of timekeeping and this very human need to know what part of the day or night you're moving through. That's all coming up this hour on Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Well, it has been a viral year for the sun, from the April total solar eclipse across America to the northern lights shimmering all the way down to Florida last month. The sun has spread light in all of our lives this year. And now our sun is back in the news as a NASA spacecraft, the Parker Solar Probe, prepares to make a historic close approach to our blazing hot star next week on Christmas Eve. Here to tell us more about this historic feat is research astrophysicist at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, Dr. Grant Mitchell. Dr. Mitchell, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're really excited to talk to you about this. So back when this Parker Solar Probe launched in 2018, we followed it on Cool Science Radio, and it's nothing short of amazing. And I imagine back in 2018, you probably didn't know the degree to which you would be involved in this project, did you?
No, oh, absolutely not. In 2018, I was in grad school and just, you know, starting to try to figure out what my PhD research was going to be on, and had the opportunity to become part of the Parker Solar Probe team, and could not be more thankful. It has just been the most amazing mission to get to be a part of, especially early in a career. It's, you know, going to be hard to top, I'll say.
Well, Katie and I were talking before we went on air about how it's amazing what you've accomplished already at this, like you say, you know, early point in your career. But was there some part of you, I said, it's because I'm sure Grant knew what he wanted to do from the time he was 6 years old. Is that right?
So it's actually really funny that you asked that. I did not know I wanted to do that. And in fact, my father is a studies cosmic rays at NASA. And so I always was, you know, did not want to go into that. Absolutely. And so, in fact, the really funny part is I went to undergrad and I was playing ice hockey as I've, you know, played my whole life. And many of the people playing sports were kinesiology majors, exercise science, basically. And so I went through, got an undergrad degree in kinesiology, explored the options after graduation for a little while, and then sort of went, okay, fine, I give in. Science is really cool. And went back, got a second undergrad in physics, and then my PhD. So it was circuitous, and not even until my early 20s that I decided to embark on this particular journey.
Well, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are talking about the Parker Solar Probe with research astrophysicist Dr. Grant Mitchell. Well, so the probe, it goes within 3.8 million miles of the sun on the 24th. Now, that may sound like a really far distance, but Earth is actually about 93 million miles. Even though 93 million or 3.8 million miles sounds like a really long way away, what do you hope to gain or learn by being that close?
Yeah, so the sun is really a constant in our skies. And we've been studying it for decades from the vantage point of the Earth. But the challenge there is that, you know, by the time all of the solar material has escaped the sun and made it to the Earth, it gets all jumbled up and it's really hard to piece apart what actually happened at the sun to make this space weather that we're observing here on Earth. So the amazing thing about Parker Solar Probe is it's passing through, it's actually the first spacecraft to pass through the solar corona, the atmosphere of the sun. And so we're able to measure the acceleration of energetic particles, the escape of the solar wind and electromagnetic fields, all of this from incredibly close to the sun. And like you said, the distance feels really big still. And, you know, oh, okay, how close are we? Well, if you imagine the sun and the Earth on separate sides of a football field, Parker Solar Probe is getting to the 4-yard line of the sun. So we're really in the red zone. We're right there, you know, making incredible measurements. It really is an unbelievable mission to be a part of.
Well, one of the things that makes Parker even possible is its heat shield. And tell us about that, because, you know, I think so often the concern with probes and interstellar travel is the cold temperatures, but this is kind of the opposite. So this has to be an amazing engineering feat in and of itself.
Oh, it's incredible. So the heat shield is this amazing, like you said, feat of engineering. When Parker Solar Probe is at its closest approach, it's the front of its heat shield is about 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit. And the amazing part is the scientific instruments that are about 6 feet back from the heat shield stay at room temperature, 85 degrees Fahrenheit. It's unbelievable. But, you know, when you think about it too, the solar corona is not very dense. And so, you know, if you think about opening your oven, you feel that hot air rushing out, but you don't get burned. And so passing through the corona is kind of like that, but just like you wouldn't want to put your hand in and grab a pan out of your oven with your bare hand, you wouldn't want to touch the front of the heat shield either. So it really is still an amazing, amazing feat of engineering.
Yeah, on that, Grant, you know, when you look up what the heat shield is made of, I would have thought it was some composite that I had never heard of before, but it's just a carbon composite. And so how does it differ from, you know, the carbon composites that we use here on Earth for various things? I mean, we know it's strong, but not impenetrable, I guess. So what is the difference, if you can go into a little more detail?
Sure. And, you know, unfortunately, I cannot take any credit for the heat shield. And you know, that was all the engineers. I'm much more on the science side. But it you know, like you say, I've actually gotten the amazing opportunity to hold a piece of the heat shield in my hand, not the one that's actually on the probe, but a spare piece. And, you know, it doesn't seem like this unbelievable feat of engineering that it is. It really is this almost foam compound. It's fairly lightweight. It you know, is able to withstand these intense temperatures and dissipate it so that it doesn't get to our scientific instruments. But I will say not one that I'm an expert on. It's a proprietary thing from the engineers, but having held it in my hand, it is both awe-inspiring and you know, also awe-inspiring in its simplicity. It's just incredible.
Right. Yeah, I bet. So another amazing thing about the Parker Solar Probe is the speed at which it is flying through space. And it made me wonder, well, if you can talk about that speed, and then it made me wonder if that's part of how it's cooled to be able to withstand the heat, or, you know, is there an interplay with the heat shield?
So that's a good question. So it is, in fact, the fastest object ever made by humans. It, you know, Parker Solar Probe has so many records. It's really an incredible mission to be a part of. It's moving so fast that it can go from Washington, D.C. to Philadelphia in about 1 second. So, you know, if everyone had a Parker Solar Probe in their garage, that would be really nice for commutes. But no, actually, The speed doesn't really play a role in its ability to dissipate heat. That's mostly just a part of its orbital dynamics. So it, Parker Solar Probe, is on this incredibly elliptical journey around the sun. It goes out to about 0.8 AU, and so that AU unit is astronomical units, and it's a really simple unit. It's just the distance between the Earth and the sun. So the Earth sits at 1 AU, just by definition of the unit. So at its farthest in each orbit, Parker Solar Probe is out at about 0.8 AU, so you know, most of the way back to the distance of the Earth, but then it goes on this super, super fast trajectory through the solar corona, where it's going thousands and thousands of degrees a second. You know, when you think of in longitude around the sun, it's just flying super fast near our sun.
Well, back, so this approach to the sun on the 24th isn't the first time Parker's come in contact, if you will, with the sun, because back on December 14th in 2021, Parker flew through the sun's upper atmosphere. What did it first find when it did, on basically, I think that was its first approach?
Yeah, so that was its first time, as you say, going through the solar corona. It had had a few, you know, perihelion, they're called, when we get closest to the sun before that. But there's this really interesting boundary between the solar corona and interplanetary space called the Alphane Zone. And, you know, I don't want to get too deep into the jargon there, but you know, when you think of the solar corona, just like the Earth's atmosphere, it's really hard to draw a demarcation line of where the corona ends and the rest of space begins. Just like the Earth's atmosphere, it's really hard to say, oh yeah, this is the spot where the atmosphere is gone and now we're in interplanetary space. So the Alphane point is this you know, essentially defined point that separates the solar corona from interplanetary space. And like you said, we first passed below the Alphane point officially into the solar corona in 2021. And that is really unprecedented. And we have learned so much about the sun ever since then by being that close and found so many mysteries. You know, that's one of the amazing things about science is you go in to answer these questions, and then your discoveries mean you get a whole bunch of new questions that that now you get to study and investigate. So it really, the mission has been providing us with all kinds of answers and new questions now for about 6 years, and it's just incredible.
Well, Parker is orbiting the sun now at a period of solar maximum, which is a lot of activity on the sun. Did NASA plan this timing, or is this just sheer luck?
Yeah, this was planned, but you know, it's always hard with schedules to guarantee that it'll happen. But like you said, this is the perfect timing to be making our closest approach. We're right now hitting solar maximum, the time when the sun is at its most active. We're getting solar flares and coronal mass ejections on a practically daily basis. And so now we're as close to the sun as we're going to be getting with this mission, getting to study these incredible solar events right up close and personal. So absolutely on purpose, but very fortunate that it did work out this way.
Grant, I'm wondering, is there something that's happening with the sun that is making the coronal mass ejections and, you know, the ability to see the solar storm all the way down in Florida, which I think is pretty unprecedented? Is what's going on that's making all this activity so prevalent now?
Yeah, so really that's another function of solar activity and being at solar max. It, you know, as a society, we're really beginning to understand more and more the importance of space weather, which, you know, for people who have not heard, the term space weather is exactly like it sounds. It's weather out in space that's driven primarily by our sun. But we're really starting to understand how important space weather is, and also beginning to understand that as we increasingly rely on space assets, satellites for all sorts of telecommunications, flying in planes, all kinds of stuff, space weather is affecting us more and more. And so the aurora is one of those space weather phenomenon that are beautiful. There are plenty of space weather effects that are a little less beautiful. But really, that's, again, just being in solar maximum and being in a fairly active solar maximum. You know, not every solar maximum is equal. And so we're in one right now that is pretty active. We're getting these big solar storms and incredible opportunities to view the aurora and learn more about these really enormous explosions. Bigger than the thing I always like to tell people is these solar flares and coronal mass ejections are actually bigger than the entire planet Earth. So, you know, if you think the explosions in action movies are cool, you know, you should check out some solar flares and coronal mass ejections.
Well, at the same time, Dr. Mitchell, we think they're pretty cool. They can also wreak havoc with what's going on right here on Earth, especially kind of toying with the way that our electromagnetism interacts with what, you know, a coronal mass ejection. Can you explain a little bit more about, you know, if these CMEs get bigger, what can it disrupt here on Earth?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And it is important, especially in our growing interconnected infrastructure, understanding more about how this space weather affects us here on Earth is of paramount importance. And so, as you say, you know, these coronal mass ejections not only accelerate particles to high energies, that's, you know, high energy radiation that can be damaging for our infrastructure and for spacecraft and electronics, also dangerous for astronauts. You know, we sometimes forget that we have the luxury of living on Earth, where we have this wonderful atmosphere protecting us from a lot of the harmful radiation produced by the sun. But increasingly, as we're preparing to send humans to the moon and eventually to Mars, that's going to be of really paramount importance, is understanding the sun, understanding space weather, and keeping our astronauts safe. And so really, you know, that's one of the big drivers to studying space weather and studying our sun. And like you said, it can affect us here on Earth. We are increasingly finding ways to safeguard our telecommunications and other infrastructure here on Earth that can be affected by space weather. But it's a huge field, and it's of growing national and international importance.
Tell us about the Parker Space Probe's namesake, Dr. Eugene Parker.
So yeah, Dr. Parker was really a pioneer in our field, one of the most incredible physicists. He, even in the 50s and 60s, predicted a lot of what couldn't even be measured at the time. I mean, it really, he had so much foresight and understood so much about how the sun worked even before we were able to measure it. He really was a pioneer in our field, so much so that, you know, I'll tell you, I have an 18-month-old son whose name is Parker, and that may not be a coincidence. So, you know, he really has had a dramatic effect on all of us. And, you know, it just could not be a better honor to remember his legacy by naming this incredible mission, pioneering mission, after him.
Well, and I was reading that he met his probe, and he was the first person to watch a launch with a probe that was bearing his name. I think that's
really right.
Cool.
He was the first living person to get to see a spacecraft named after him or herself be launched. And I really hope he felt how much he means to our community.
Yeah. Oh, that's very cool. Well, Dr. Grant Mitchell is a research astrophysicist at NASA Goddard, and he has joined us today to talk about how the Parker Solar Probe prepares to make a historic close approach to our blazing hot star at 430,000 miles per hour and 3.8 million miles from our sun on December 24th, Christmas Eve. Grant, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. This has been really great.
Thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
Humans have been tracking time, well, throughout time. From monolithic structures to mark seasonal events, to sundials to indicate what part of the day you're experiencing, to atomic clocks that measure microseconds. The ways we have measured time are as broad as the time between these methods. But what is time anyway, and why have we felt the need to track it? Joining us to talk about this truly human desire is Chad Orzel, Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Union College in Schenectady, New York, and author of the book, A Brief History of Timekeeping. Chad, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
So I remember a few years ago reading some comment or a meme, if you will, and the quote attributed to the Buddha said, "If you're too busy to meditate for 20 minutes, you should meditate for an hour." And that really got me thinking, did the Buddha measure time in minutes and seconds and hours like that? So how long have we been using the time delineations that we now use, like minutes, hours, seconds?
So the basic idea of dividing things up into 12s goes back thousands of years. And it's basically, I think the origin of that seems to be that there are roughly 12 or 13 full moons in a year. So, you know, that's a really obvious thing that you see in the world. And so you start chopping the year up into 12 parts. And then, you know, then you start doing that to days and nights as well. And that, you know, works pretty well. So we've had divisions that are sort of effectively like an hour for thousands of years. People have been keeping track of that. They used to do it as parts of like the night. So, you know, an hour at night was 1/12 of the time between sunset and sunrise, which means that over the course of the year, they would have to change time. They would have to change length because, you know, in the winter, the nights get longer and in the summer, the nights get shorter. So you would need your hours would get longer and shorter. And it's actually one of the oldest examples of a sophisticated clock that we have is this clepsydra from ancient Egypt. And there's a tomb inscription by a guy who brags about inventing a clock that could keep track of the changing hours of the night through the year. And all it is it's a container kind of shaped like a flower pot with a hole in the middle of the bottom, and water, you fill it with water and it drains out slowly. And then it just has 12 different sets of markings around the edge that have different spaced lines that correspond to the different months of the Egyptian calendar. And so this is how long an hour is in each of these times.
Wow.
That's from around 1500 BCE. So, you know, over 3,000 years ago.
Wow. So, I mean, I think we can all understand the necessity for seasonal tracking with, you know, planting and harvesting. But what is it about our almost obsession with breaking time into these little teeny chunks?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for just the problem of coordinating people, right? Once you start to get groups of people living together that's, you know, larger than a couple of families in neighboring houses, then you kind of need a way to subdivide the day to start saying, okay, you know, you and I need to meet to conduct some sort of business. We're going to do it at this time so that I'm not sitting around for half the day waiting for that to take place. And so, you know, then as you start to get bigger concentrations of you know, more concentrated society, then you start to see more and more finer divisions of time. But like the really fine divisions don't start being a thing until relatively recently, until, you know, a few hundred years ago, when you start to get mechanical clocks. The first clocks that were built in Europe didn't have minute hands. They only had hour hands because they weren't very reliable at the level of minutes, but, you know, through the course of a day, it was about good for telling you what hour it was.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Chad Orzel. He's an associate professor of physics and astronomy. Well, Chad, because you're into physics and astronomy, it may not be the correct question to ask you, but I'm going to ask anyway about why when daylight savings ends, as it did recently, why is it such a huge effect on our bodies, just 1 hour? And how, if we travel for even from our West Coast to our East Coast, you know, that 3 hour disruption can be so great. Do you have any theories on that?
Yeah, I think it's a big disruption because you're changing your sleep cycle and things like that gets thrown off very, very easily. And, you know, we evolved in a world where, you know, nobody could go all that far in the course of a day. So you couldn't, you know, the time is different in different locations, but you couldn't move fast enough to ever really see that until relatively recently, until basically the mid 1800s. You got American railroads to the point where you could, in the course of a single day, go, you know, from one modern time zone to another. And then you would really start to notice that, wait a minute, the sun, you know, should have been down a while ago, and, you know, it's still up in the sky. What's going on here? And that's very disorienting because, you know, you get sort of, over a long time, you become accustomed to a particular cycle of now it's light, now it's dark, now it's light, now it's dark. And that changes only very slowly. And when you suddenly shift that by an hour, either by, you know, the clock change or by traveling a long distance, then it's very, very disruptive. But yeah, I find the fall back not that bad.
Right.
Because, you know, it's an extra hour sleep. I get to, you know, spend a little more time in bed in the morning. My dog finds it very disconcerting. Like all the food is suddenly showing up an hour late. It's the worst thing that ever happened.
I know it is funny how just an extra hour in the day, I don't know if it's physiologically or psychologically, but it feels like the biggest gift. And like how, and that entire day when daylight savings ends, you know, the Sunday, you feel like you've been given this bonus, this huge gift, and it's only 1 hour, but
yeah,
so significant.
At least you feel that until, like, you know, until the sun sets at 5 p.m. and they're like, oh, this is terrible.
Exactly. You know, I wanted to talk about how, like, precise we are with time. And yet, you know, here we are in the mountain standard time zone. And the difference between Salt Lake City and Denver being on, you know, longitudinal lines that are, you know, 8 hours apart by car, if you're driving, the time is not the same at all between those two. And you mentioned that we've only been, you know, standardizing time zones for, is it a couple hundred years?
It's the modern time zones comes in the 1880s in the U.S. And it happens in the most American way possible, which is it's imposed by railroad companies to avoid having the government do it. That they decided they needed to coordinate schedules over large zones, and there were some astronomers and scientists lobbying to standardize time, and they got the attention of a very powerful fellow in the railroad industry, who said, you know what, if we let them get to Congress with this, they're going to come up with something we won't like. So the railroads just agreed on boundaries between rail companies as, you know, we're going to make a 1 hour change at these points, and just sort of instituted that system on the railroads. And then most local towns were taking their time from the railways anyway, because the railroads had telegraph lines running with them, and they would get sort of centralized time signals to synchronize clocks. And so everybody just very smoothly adopted it. But it was actually an industry measure that went through to sort of preempt Congress. So it doesn't get more American than that.
Well, Chad, I remember reading the book Longitude about the British clockmaker who actually solved the longitude problem, and was fascinated to discover that that's where the starting point for Greenwich Mean Time came from, was the Brits said, well, no, we're starting here. And I know they were having some conflicts with the French, but for our listeners who haven't read the book Longitude, tell us about the importance of the clock that this clockmaker was able to create and how he affected timekeeping going forward.
Yeah, so the problem of longitude is, you know, as you go north and south, you can figure out where you are relatively easy by looking at how high the sun is at noon, or by looking at how high the North Star is above the horizon. So you can figure out your latitude really easily, but longitude, you know, there isn't an east pole, there isn't a west pole, right? It just goes around and around and around. And so the only way to measure changes in longitude is changes in the relative position of the sun at different times. So, you know, I'm currently in Schenectady on the East Coast, and, you know, the sun is, you know, like kind of halfway down the sky. Where I am, it's probably, you know, about as high as it's going to be where you are, right? Because you're a couple hours to the west of me. So, you know, that difference is something you have to determine. And the problem is, you know, in the absence of Zoom or telephones or things like that, there isn't a good way to communicate what time it is in, say, London to a distant location and say, okay, well, you know, right here, the sun is directly overhead. Where you are, the sun is there. Therefore, our time difference is this. Therefore, our longitude difference is whatever it is. So there are two ways you can do this before our modern telecommunications. One is by looking at the position of objects in the sky. So looking at the moon, looking at the stars, which requires a bunch of work and a bunch of math to calculate it. The other thing you can do is make a really good clock that you set in your home port, and then you carry it with you and it just keeps time. And then you know what your longitude is. Making a clock that's good enough to do that, particularly on the deck of a sailing ship in the 1700s, is really incredibly difficult. And so this fellow named John Harrison is the first to pull it off. And he did it with almost superhuman effort in the mid-1700s. He invented new techniques for compensating changes in temperature. He used little chips of diamond to reduce friction in the gears of the clock. And, you know, it's this really fantastic effort that he went to and succeeded in making a clock that was good enough. And then, you know, other people said, okay, how do we engineer this to be less taxing on our construction, and made, you know, eventually toward our modern era of mass-produced watches.
Well, as I was reading through some of your book and other history of timekeeping, I was fascinated to read about water clocks, and nothing I'd ever really heard of. I mean, we've all seen the sand hourglasses that you'll turn upside down, but the water clocks, how effective were those, and how did they work other than just water dripping through a hole?
It's the, you know, the second oldest form of timekeeping technology that exists, after, you know, you hammer a stick in the ground and look at the shadow, and that's a sundial, essentially. Water clocks were the technology all the way up into the Renaissance, really. Galileo making his initial measurements of things to do with pendulums and other physics was using a water clock. He would let water run into a container and then weigh the water to determine how much time had passed. So they can be really extremely good. And it's a technology that goes back thousands of years. And it really is just, you know, it can be as simple as you have a container with a small hole in it and water drains out slowly. And you ask, you know, you look at how much water has come out and say, that's how much time has passed.
Wow. Yeah, that was the first time that I had heard of a water clock or understood what it was from your book, A Brief History of Timekeeping. I'm wondering if you in your classes at Union College in Schenectady have your students do this. I mean, how do you create the correct size hole for the water drop to come through to know that you're getting the correct?
Yeah, it's a lot of trial and error. I've done the origin of the book is actually a class I taught a few times called A Brief History of Timekeeping. And in the class, I would have students do some sort of project to you know, measure time. And, you know, I get a lot of people making sundials, some people playing around with mechanical watches. But every time we did it, somebody would make a water clock. And it's a lot of, like, you know, well, I get a tube and I poke a little hole in it, and then we're going to see how long it takes for this to drain, comparing it to something else, and you can kind of calibrate that and see. The really tricky thing is the rate at which it drains out changes as the water level drops. So there's a variety of clever things you can do to try to keep that water level constant. And that's the really clever engineering part that people come up with, is these systems of, multiple containers, one that's draining and that's producing the flow of water that you use to measure time. But there's another one that's refilling the one that you're taking water out of, to keep the water level constant so that it's really consistent. And there's a ton of engineering, but it's basically all trial and error. It's you set it up and you try it and like, I made that hole too big, this is draining too fast, gotta start again. And
yeah, that's kind of fun. I'm wondering if in your brief history of timekeeping and looking back through history, if those at who settled closer to the equator, where days and nights are pretty consistently the same length throughout the year, versus those who depended on sundials for crops and everything was very seasonal at these higher latitudes, did cultures develop in a way that they were more attached to time versus those who, it's all kind of the same. It doesn't really matter what time it is. The seasons are similar.
It's a little tough to say because, the cultures from which we have good written records, right, are all in Eurasia, right? It's all Western Europe through China and Japan. And they are all trading with each other over periods of a couple thousand years. So they all have calendar systems and timekeeping systems that are pretty similar because they're talking to each other all the time. The really interesting example is the Maya in Central America had this very elaborate calendar system, and so they're at equatorial latitudes.
Yeah.
They're north of the equator, but in the tropics. And there's a really interesting system there that a lot of their architecture includes events that just aren't seen as important because they don't happen in the northern latitudes. So there are ways to calculate sort of the zenith crossing day, the day on which the noonday sun is directly overhead. And then for part of the year, it'll be north of the sun at noon will be north of the directly overhead. And for the rest of the year, it'll be south of directly overhead. The Maya have, massive temples constructed that mark that, right? That have constructions that mark those dates, because those are significant if you're in the tropics. So they don't have as much change in the length of the day, but they do see the same change in the position of the sun. And they did have very, very careful ways of tracking that. The Maya were also really interested in the movement of the planets. And so some of the few surviving written documents we have from them are tables of rising and setting times for Venus and Mars and things like that. And they were keeping very close track of those.
Well, Chad, I want to talk about watches. And so 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, I was a volunteer for the COVID vaccine clinic and people were checking in. And what I found so fascinating is there was a split in demographics. If you were under a certain age, you pulled out your phone to look at what time it was to check in. And if you were over a certain age, I noticed people either looking at their watch or looking for a clock. And so immediately bought a clock. And so many kids today don't wear watches. But that's not even a question, it's more of a statement. But what I'm really wondering about is, like, we all grew up with an analog face, the 12, the hands, the minutes. And so to me, I look at time as more of a perspective throughout the day because I see a clock face. But so many people, especially kids these days, look at a digital version of the time on their cell phones. How is that changing their perspective of time?
It's definitely interesting. It's a running joke with my kids that I'll, you know, they'll ask, you know, what time is it? And I'll say it's, you know, 20 of. And then my about to be 13-year-old will look at me and go, "Dad, use numbers." And like, you know, so like, no, it's, you know, it's 22, you know, it means it's 12:40. It's 20 of one. And, you know, they don't think about it that way. They're used to looking at digital numbers. They do still in school do the clock face because it's useful to be able to do, you know, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock for, you know, directions, if nothing else. But it is a real change in attitude that people are used to looking at digital time now. And having, you know, the smartphone time is good. You know, that's good to within a, you know, seconds of you know, the Greenwich Mean Time, or, you know, UTC, the official time scale for the world. So, you know, it's really incredibly good.
Well, let's talk more about watches, because I'm fascinated with watches when you see beautifully made, very, very expensive. It seems like watches can easily cost more than cars. What is the fascination with this little timepiece that you will wear on your wrist that's typically an analog face?
Yeah, the funny thing about it is, right, that nowadays, right, if you go and buy, you know, a cheap Casio watch at, you know, at the store, like a digital watch that you can pick up for 10 bucks is going to keep time as well as a multi-$1,000 mechanical watch. So, you know, there's this sort of status shift. In the late 1800s, they got really good at manufacturing mechanical watches. So it got to where, you know, everybody could have a watch for like $1 a day, which is about, you know, a day's labor if you were working a manual job. So everybody, you know, democratized time. You could have these mechanical watches. But, you know, they're very labor intensive to make. You need to you know, you need the gears to mesh together perfectly. You need the spring and the drive system to be matched very well. And, you know, there's a lot of effort that goes into that. And at some point in the mid 20th century, people figured out you could make little quartz oscillators that are electronic that are way lower maintenance than the mechanical workings of a mechanical watch. And so quartz watches just blow away any of the mechanical things. And so they flip. They sort of become the mechanical watches that were the democratization of timekeeping become these luxury items, become these things that, you know, they're meticulously crafted, they're hand assembled, and that costs an arm and a leg. Whereas these quartz things are now, they're mass produced, they're super cheap. You know, there's quartz oscillators in all sorts of places that, you know, everything these days has a digital clock in it. Those all have little quartz oscillators in them because they cost like, you know, 4 cents. And, you know, you just throw it in there with all the other electronics.
Why does the quartz oscillator keep time so perfectly? What is it? What are the physics?
It's just you know, a happy coincidence of material properties, really. Quartz does a thing, it's called the piezoelectric effect, which is if you squeeze a quartz crystal in the right direction, it generates a voltage in a perpendicular direction. Or if you apply a voltage to it, the crystal will get a little bigger or a little smaller. So you can make a little thing shaped like a tuning fork, and you sort of hit it with a voltage, and it'll ring at like a tuning fork at a very particular frequency. And you can monitor that frequency by looking at the voltage that develops as it shakes back and forth. And so you can excite it electronically, you can measure it electronically. And it turns out that as a material, quartz is remarkably insensitive to changes in temperature. The frequency at which those little tuning forks vibrate, if you cut the crystal the right way, that frequency doesn't change very much as it heats up or cools down. So it's a really, really stable oscillator that you can use.
Atomic clocks, I think we sort of take it for granted. I believe all of our smartphones run on an atomic clock, as do our computers.
They take the time from an atomic clock as a reference. Yeah.
Right, so. Right. As we were talking about before we went on air, this interview we just did about the changing velocity of the rotation of the Earth and that having an influence on our universal timekeepers and how we actually set those atomic clocks and all of these requests, like electronic requests throughout the world that are making slight little requests of a change of the atomic clock. I think that's just fascinating. Can you, for the layperson, explain how the atomic clock works?
Yeah, atomic clock is a little bit of a misnomer because the thing that's doing the ticking in the clock is actually light. So your atomic clock is really, it's a source of microwaves that oscillate at a particular frequency. It's 9,192,631,770 oscillations per second is the microwave frequency that's at the heart of a modern atomic clock. What you need is what the atoms do is the atoms provide a reference that allows you to know that you're at exactly that frequency. So the atoms, because of quantum mechanics, will only absorb and emit light at very specific frequencies. And every cesium atom in the universe is identical to every other cesium atom in the universe, will absorb and emit light only at very specific frequencies, and they're all the same. So you can use a cesium atom as a reference to check your microwave source. So the way an atomic clock works is you get a bunch of cesium atoms, you synchronize them with the microwave source you have in the lab, then you let them evolve for a while, you leave them alone for a little bit, and then you check back and see, are they still in sync with the microwave source? If they are, then you know your microwave source is at exactly, you know, 9,192,631,770 oscillations per second. And then, you know, that gives you your time signal. If they're a little bit off, then you tweak the frequency up a little bit or down a little bit and try it again. And by doing that, you can make clocks that are good enough that a state-of-the-art atomic clock is good enough that if you had two of them and ran them continuously, it would take something like a billion years for them to drift apart by 1 second. Wow. So really just astonishingly good timekeeping.
Well, Chad, I hate to say it, we have run out of time. We'll have to have you on another time so we can talk more about time. Well, our guest today has been Chad Ozell. He is the author of the book, A Brief History of Timekeeping. He is also an associate professor of physics and astronomy at Union College in Schenectady. And Chad, we will also leave links to your website because you also have all sorts of other fun information and books like teaching quantum mechanics to your dog. And so I know our listeners will be really interested in all that because we are very much a dog town and we think our dogs are very smart. Chad, thank you for taking the time to join us on Cool Science Radio.
And thank you for having me on. This was fun.